pull up a chair. I want you to stand out on the vintage rows here at Whitman Field for a second. It's Oshkosh Week. AirVenture. The biggest gathering of airplanes and the people who love them anywhere on Earth, and it's happening right now all around us. Corrugated trim odors, yellow cubs by the hundred, warbirds warming up down on the far end. And somewhere in the middle of all that beautiful noise, I want to tell you about an airplane that most folks were smart enough to be afraid of. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar. The show where we sit with the old iron and the old stories and try to remember why any of us fell in love with this in the first place. Today we go back to the Golden Age, back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, and a handful of brothers in Massachusetts built the most dangerous, most beautiful, most misunderstood racer of the whole era, the GB. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. That's the whole idea, isn't it? A little piece of brass in your pocket that says you were there, you did the thing, you earned it. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, Springfield, Massachusetts, the tail end of the 1920s, there were five Granville brothers, and the one who mattered most for our story was Zanford. Everybody called him Granny. Now, Granny Granville was not a college-trained engineer. He was a mechanic, a tinkerer, a man who understood airplanes the way a horse trainer understands a horse. By feel, by long hours, by his hands. The brothers set up shop under the name Granville Brothers Aircraft. Take the first letters, GBGB. And in the beginning they built sensible little sport biplanes. Nice airplanes, honest airplanes. Nobody remembers them. Here's what people remember. In those days, air racing was the biggest show in America. Bigger than you can probably imagine sitting here in 2026. When the national air races came to town, 100,000 people would pack the grandstands. The pilots were household names, front page of the paper, the way ball players were. And the two trophies everybody wanted were the Bendix, which was a flat-out cross-country dash from coast to coast, and the Thompson, which was the one that made your heart stop. The Thompson was closed course, pylon racing, 10 airplanes screaming around a set of towers at rooftop height, wingtip to wingtip, pulling turns so hard the pilots grayed out. The Granville brothers looked at that, and they had one idea, one pure, ruthless, beautiful idea: build the smallest possible airframe you can bolt around the biggest possible engine. Now here's where it gets interesting. Most designers, they start with the wing, they start with lift, with stability, with how the thing is going to behave, when the weather turns ugly and the pilot's tired. The Granvilles didn't care about any of that. They started with a Pratt & Whitney Wasp radial engine, a great big 14-cylinder, and later a 9-cylinder that put out over 700 horsepower, and they asked a different question entirely. How little airplane can we get away with wrapping around this monster? The answer was the Model R, the Super Sportster. Picture it, and I mean really picture it, because there has never been anything else that looked quite like it. The fuselage is shaped like a teardrop, fat, barrel-chested, all-engine up front, tapering back to almost nothing at the tail. The cockpit is jammed way, way back, right up against the vertical fin, so far aft that the pilot can barely see over that enormous cowling in front of him. The wings are tiny, stubby little things that look like somebody ordered them a size too small. And the whole airplane sits up on these long, spatted landing gear legs like a bulldog standing on its toes. It was, by any honest measure, an engine with a seat behind it. They built two of them for the 1932 season, the R1 and the R2. Painted in that unforgettable scheme, black and white on top with the number 7 and later the number 11 on the sides. Scalloped paint like something off a circus wagon. And they were fast. Lord, were they fast. Let me back up one year, though, because you can't understand the GB without understanding the price that was already being paid. The season before, 1931, the Granvilles had a smaller racer called the Model Z. The city of Springfield. A young pilot named Lowell Bales flew it, and he won the Thompson with it, beat everybody. Then he went out to set a world landplane speed record, and on one of those blistering low passes, something let go. Some folks say a fuel cap tore loose and cracked the windscreen. Whatever it was, the airplane pitched up, and it came apart in the air, and Lowell Bales was gone. There's film of it, hard film to watch. So the brothers knew. They knew these airplanes lived right on the edge of what was possible, and the edge had teeth. But 1932. The Super Sportster. They needed a pilot with the skill and the nerve to take the R1 to Cleveland for the Thompson. They got the best there was, James Doolittle. Now, I know you all know that name for other things he did later, but set all that aside, In 1932, Jimmy Doolittle was simply the finest, most scientific pilot in America, a man with an actual doctorate in aeronautics who also happened to have ice water in his veins. And when he climbed into that GB, he did something the Granvilles maybe hadn't fully counted on. He didn't just fly it, he studied it. He tested it. He got to know exactly where the edge was before he ever went racing, and on the race course he was untouchable. He won the Thompson Trophy that year. And in a separate run, he pushed the Super Sportster to a new world land plane speed record. Better than 296 miles per hour, faster than anything on wheels had ever gone. But listen to what Doolittle said about it afterward. This is the part that matters. He said, quote, "She is the sweetest ship I've ever flown, but she is a killer." He said flying her was like balancing a pencil on the tip of your finger. Any inattention, any distraction, and she would bite. He knew. The best pilot in the country flew that airplane to a record and to a trophy, and then he looked at it clear-eyed and told the truth about it. That was the golden age in one sentence, friends. Sweetest ship I ever flew and a killer, both at once. Here's the thing history did to the Geebee, though, and here's where I want to set the record a little straighter, because I've been hearing it told wrong for 50 years. The airplanes did keep killing people. Russell Boardman died in an R-1 down in Indianapolis in 1933. Other pilots came to grief in GBs and GB derivatives, and so the legend calcified. The GB became the boogeyman. The flying coffin. The airplane that was fundamentally hopelessly evil. A design so flawed it was practically homicidal. That's the story that got passed down. That's the story in half the books. And it took a man named Delmar Benjamin to prove that story was wrong. Now come back with me from the 1930s all the way up to the modern era of this very show of AirVenture. Because this is why I'm telling you this standing here at Oshkosh. In the early 1990s, Delmar Benjamin and a craftsman named Steve Wolf decided to build a flying replica of the Geebee R2. Not a static museum piece, not a thing to hang from a ceiling. A real flying, honest reproduction of the most feared racer of the Golden Age. Everybody told them the same thing, don't, it'll kill you the way it killed the others. The airplane is unflyable, the airplane is a death trap. Everybody knew that, Delmar Benjamin didn't believe everybody. He and Wolf went back to the original engineering, and what they came to understand was that the Geebee wasn't evil. It was demanding. There's a world of difference. It was an airplane with almost no natural stability, a short-coupled, twitchy, high-powered thoroughbred that would not tolerate a lazy pilot or a distracted moment. But if you respected it, if you stayed ahead of it every single second, if you flew it with your whole attention the way Doolittle did, it would do exactly what you asked. So Delmar Benjamin built his Geebee, and then he did something nobody in 60 years had dared to do. He flew it in air shows, aerobatics, loops, rolls, hammerheads, the whole routine, in the airplane that had a reputation as a widowmaker. And he brought it here. He flew that fat, snarling, black and white teardrop right down the show line at Oshkosh, at AirVenture, in front of hundreds of thousands of people who had only ever seen the Geebee in old photographs and grainy newsreels of crashes. I want you to imagine what that was like. The sound alone. That big radial hammering away. And this impossible-looking airplane, all engine and attitude, carving through the Wisconsin sky and doing it gracefully. Making it look, if not easy, then at least possible, proving that the Golden Age legend had been half-myth all along. That the airplane was not a murderer. It was just an airplane that refused to carry anyone who wasn't fully present. That is a very pilot lesson, isn't it? The Geebee doesn't care how good you used to be. It cares how good you are right now, this second, this turn. And that's what the Golden Age really was. When you strip away the goggles and the scarves and the romance, it was a bunch of mechanics and dreamers with more courage than data, building airplanes that flew right at the ragged edge of the possible, learning the hard truths, the only way anybody learned anything back then, in the air. Sometimes at a terrible cost, every clean, docile, forgiving airplane you and I get to fly today. Every airplane parked out here on this field this week sits on top of lessons those people paid for. Now walk these grounds this week and you'll feel all of it. That's the thing about this place. AirVenture isn't a museum where the past is behind glass. It's alive. The Golden Age airplanes out here. The racers, the classics from that era. They fire up and they fly. The idea that Paul Poberesny planted all those years ago, when the Experimental Aircraft Association was just a handful of home builders in a basement in Wisconsin. That idea has grown into the one place on Earth where a kid can stand 10 feet from a screaming radial engine and understand, in his bones, why some of us never got over this. The Geebee, the whole reckless, gorgeous Golden Age, it isn't a story we read here, it's a story we can still hear. So the next time somebody tells you the GB was nothing but a death trap, you tell them about Jimmy Doolittle, who called it the sweetest ship he ever flew, and you tell them about Delmar Benjamin, who built one and flew it down the line at Oshkosh and made the whole world reconsider. The airplane was never the villain. The airplane was just honest. It gave you exactly what you brought to it. My thanks today to the good folks at the EAA Aviation Museum and the historians who've kept the Granville Brothers story alive, and to the flight test writers who set the flying record straight over the years. If you want more of this kind of thing, we live at RadioHangar.com. Go find the vintage rose before you leave here this week. Stand close, listen to one of those old engines catch and rumble. That sound is the Golden Age talking to you, and it's still got plenty to say. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down.